You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9:59 a.m.
You're tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is Medea Benjamin. I hope you listen to Community Radio KBOO 90.7.
Sitting in the rain, waiting on the sun to shine.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We are on remote. Cornelius Eady is here with us, poet, playwright, librettist, professor, musician. How do you like listening to your own music, Cornelius?
Well, Grace, I don't like listening to the sound of my own voice. It could be a bad, impression. But I do enjoy listening to my band, Charlie Rao and Lisa Liu. They're fantastic musicians, and it always brings me joy to hear them interact with one another.
So tell us something about making that music, the songs and the lyrics. Tell us how you did that.
Well, that song is the end of a long year, last year, when everyone was in lockdown. And what I did in lockdown was to simply start writing songs, because partly to keep the trio together, right? We didn't know what we were going to do, because gigs just disappeared, right? They just went, in a 72-hour period, and so we didn't know where we were going to play again, where we were going to perform again. So we just to keep our spirits up more than anything else. It wasn't like I'm going to now do this project, but it was sort of like song by song, and at the end of that process. A producer from the BBC, BBC Radio 4, learned about the project and wanted to do a 30-minute show about my pandemic folk song project, which we now was calling Don't Get Dead. And he wanted an upbeat song to end the radio show. And I was we're all kind of like, I'm a beat show. I don't want to do it. This is a pandemic. But I pushed myself to write an upbeat song, and it turned it into Sunshine, which turned out to be a really wonderful song, but which we love.
Very beautiful. We will be talking more about your music later on in the program. But because you are first and foremost one of America's greatest poets, let us hear a poem.
Okay. But I'll do a newer one, music-based one. This is actually based on a conversation I had with the poet Afa Weaver. And Afa was working on a memoir, and he was on the chapter where he was talking about the first time he heard Miles Davis' famous album, Kind of Blue. And I was thinking, oh, my God, that's right. We all have that. Most of us have that experience of the first time we heard Kind of Blue. So it kicked off the poem, this poem called Kind of. My friend is writing about the first time he listened to Kind of Blue by Miles Davis. And I tell him, yes, I bet everyone has a story, kind of like their first kiss. How did it happen? Where were you? On which of your younger days did Paul Chambers' bass first lick your ear? Did you first think you didn't want anything to do with that crazy stuff? No words, no verse, chorus, music for sunglasses and cigarette holders? Did one of your friends, a convert, drag you to the stereo, fired up by the sight of a world wider than the narrow, invisible rails you were running on? The record is famous for this. The record that readjusts your opinion, and you pause. The needle has hit a new groove. On which of your younger days did the afternoon simmer down and that smoothness called out to you, and then everything else?
Simmer down, simmer down. Your word choices are music in themselves. Michael Off of Weaver,
that's right,
had on the show in 1977, or so I need to get him back.
Yes, you do.
I think every 45 years.
He's written a lot since then.
He was brilliant then.
Yes.
I think he had Seven Sons Press. He was brilliant then. He is brilliant now. Yes. And so are you, Cornelius Eady. He is the author of many books, two prize-winning ones that I can think of. Victims of the Latest Dance Craze won the Lamont.
Right.
A Gathering of My Voice.
My Name was nominated for a Pulitzer.
Yes, it was a Pulitzer nominee.
Right.
And you have done many, many things. But let us hear one more poem before we go into your psyche.
Okay. Okay.
Which must be quite a journey.
Do you want to go into your psyche? Okay, here's a Billie Holiday poem. This is a newer one. I tend to go back to writing about Billie periodically. Just get drawn back to her. And this one's called Trees. Trees. There is a song that Billie Holiday sang concerning trees. She didn't write it, but when she sang, when she opened her mouth, she blew a sickening wind. Ash, rope, the lowering branch, blackened fruit. It was a southern pitch, particular to that soil. When she sang, you'd feel her fabric bleed, unjust notes turning flesh to butter, unscrewing the cap between here and void, all sparrow and magpie calls polluted. She'd sing this night after night, the last thing you'd hear before you drain your glass and walk back into the world, your city, your block, trees thrumming rough bark in an evening gown. Here you go, the bad gardenia sang. Here's how we rise through strangulation.
Cornelius Eady, pitch particular to that soil. You know, jazz will never die.
No.
Not only because of its sound, but because of cultural historians like you who keep it alive with language. But how did a poet, everyone wants to know, how a poet becomes a musician, how do you parlay that great energy that you had for language into sound? How did you become a songwriter from poet?
Well, there's no transition there. I always was writing songs, you know, it's neck and neck, right? Right. When I was younger, I was writing songs. I was in bands. My wife and I.
Oh, I didn't know. I didn't know.
Yeah, my wife and I were in a rock band, I've been doing it on a parallel course throughout my writing career. It's just that I didn't put more emphasis on the songwriting. At a certain point, as I said to friends many times, you know, and also in interviews, there came a point where poetry got the upper hand, right? It just seemed like that was the path I was really supposed to be on, and I stopped writing songs less and less and less. But at a certain point, like around 2012 or 13, the pendulum started to swing back.
You have so many gifts, it's almost not fair. You should share a little. And so now another poem. Cornelius Eady. Cornelius Eady.
Okay. I'll do a jazz poem. This is about Thelonious Monk. And this is about a famous scuffle they had that was done on tape between Miles and Thelonious and, you know, Milt Jackson. They were recording a tune, "The Man I Love," on Christmas Eve, 1954. And if you listen to it, there's two takes of the opening. First take is basically they're starting it, and then Miles has second thoughts about Monk playing it because you know how it is with jazz musicians. It isn't how fast you can play; it's the ballad that tells you that proves if you got chops right or not. And Miles started to think that, well, you know, Monk being Thelonious being Thelonious, he's got to just do what he does. And I don't, it needs to be pretty and you know, soulful. He's just going to do, he's going to do his fractured stuff. I don't want that. So you hear them starting, and then you hear Milt Jackson starting the head of the song. And then there's a like a commotion. And then you hear, and you hear Miles' voice going around, lay out, right? He's telling Monk to lay out. You know, I don't want you to play on this, right? And then he goes over to the engineer, was Rudy, right? What's the space, the great engineer, and said, "Get this down, Rudy, all of it."
Oh, this is right? Wonderful. This is wonderful.
That stops, and it starts up again, right? It starts with take two, right? And then there's this beautiful opening. With Milt Jackson, right? It's better than the first one, right? And then they play the song, and of course he's right. When Monk does his solo, you know, he does ba 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 ba.
We have never had such a setup for a poem ever.
I know, Mike, too much of a setup,
our engineer is in heaven, listening to you. I'm telling you.
But I've always loved that moment because. Not only because of the conflict, but also because Miles decided for some reason that it needed to be prime time. They needed to keep that on the record, right? Right? That's the only reason we know about it, right? So, anyway, piano solo, Thelonious Monk on "The Man I Love." On the first take, Miles Davis tells Monk, strange-fingered Thelonious, to shut up, to lay out. It's a ballad. No tinkling brown pixie dust against the groove, no waddling through the measures like an albatross stalks up to the skies. Miles is a man who is used to having his own way. And if Monk were a woman, who knows where this might end? But then Milt Jackson rethinks the intro, the hushed tones of a man clearing his throat before his chords vibrate in prayer. And these five men, who seem to have nothing better to do, Christmas Eve, 1954, get back to the lyric. Love is food, water, air. Lonely sucks. Then from out of the negotiation, clinks Monk. Toy piano Monk. That stumble bum bird. The boy who will always grab the wrong crayon.
You know what? You make me cry. I'm not kidding. You just make me cry. Oh. It's just your heart, Cornelius. It is just your heart that just is in your words. I swear, I needed you today so much. I mean it. I saw Miles the last time he was in Washington, and all he did was one note. He got out on stage, and he played. We waited a long time, and he just played one note with his back to the audience. That was, I'll never forget that note.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that note.
Yeah.
And you are memorializing these in such a way that it makes me cry. That's all I can say, that my body does not lie. But we have to go into all of your lives, and one of them is that you are professor of English after a stellar career in colleges. Professor of English at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville and Chair of Excellence.
Right.
Tell me this, through your long career, when you encounter people who want to be poets, how do you begin? How do you start? What is the first thing you say?
Oh, well, the first thing they ask me, they usually don't ask you how to be a poet. They're already there by the time they arrive at a program. They've already made some choices and some considerations and changed the direction of their lives, you know, in a certain way towards that right? And I see, I always see that is like you, it's the first step towards your, towards the invention of your future self, the writer that you're going to, that's the public poet that's going to emerge 5 to 6 years from now, right? Right. Those are the baby steps. It's a, but that's the desire. That's being, that's going towards you. And what I do, hopefully, is try to make them aware of what the tools are, what the tools they have, and how best to you know, hone those tools to discover how they want to say what they want to say as they move through experience. But sometimes writing is about just taking, you know, taking a chance, taking a leap, right? Or being able to give themselves permission to say stuff they don't think they can say, mm-hmm. right? That happens a lot, you know. We see that a lot at Carvey Con to bring that up.
Yes.
A lot of times I've noticed over the 25 years we've done Carvey Con that there's some poets, even poets that are in MFA or PhD programs, sometimes reserve the time at Carvey Con to say the poem they couldn't say anyplace else, to write the poem that touched the story they couldn't touch anyplace else, because they feel that that's the only way they can do that. They can't do it in their MFA program. They can't do it, you know, in the academy, you know. But they feel safe enough to be able to say that.
We will want to talk more about Carvey Con, because that is one of America's greatest cultural institutions. And but while we have you, one more poem. Make me cry.
Well, okay, I'm not going to make you cry. I mean, I feel really bad now.
I needed your spirit. You know, when you encounter a great spirit, I just want to get on my knees and say thank you. And that's what I'm feeling. Your spirit is just incredibly divine. It's just connected to the divine. And that's what these tears are saying.
You are so sweet, Grace.
No,
let me do something and not be like that's going to move you to tears. Hopefully, this is a poem about Aretha Franklin at Obama's inauguration. That one thing about that wonderful hat she wore, right? right. And connection to my sister. So Aretha Franklin's inaugural hat. Look at that hat. My mother might have said, sitting in that bunker the living room had become, her favorite shows interrupted by the sight of this woman who once sang my sister through one of her major heartbreaks, "An I give then take away man," with a truth which rose through the house. I was too young to know which kind of truth, really, and my sister was now learning the words. Her belly would swell from it. Ain't no way, ain't no way, sang the girl who was slightly older than my sister, old enough to teach it. Ain't no way, ain't no way. The needle scratched and scratched again. It's not too far-fetched to think of it breaking skin, a rush of something toxic, tear-raising. Remember when she didn't want to tell us, but told us, by playing that damn record all day, over and over in her bedroom. That's the woman, that's the woman under that hat, I tell my mother. If she'd ask, that church hat, that black woman's hat, that testimony hat.
That's the woman under the hat, all right. That's the woman under the hat, for sure. Are you on any more of these new poems? Are you on further and farther with more of these cultural icons?
Well, those are kind of older poems. I read the first two poems, which were kind of new. I'm kind of gathering up the next book.
What's it going to be about?
There's a lot of things that there's a lot of threads going on right now. One thread is a series of poems I'm writing about Phyllis Wheatley. And you know, the emphasis on this cycle is her, you know, the transition from her own native tongue to English. What it might have felt like to lose her tongue, and then learn how to do how to speak.
How much have you accomplished?
I've got about 12 or so poems done by now.
Just beginning.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. But it's an ongoing thing. And if you read her book, her one book, that was published in England, and then, you know.
I do know her poems.
Right. You will notice every so often, threaded through the book, she will give reference to the memory of being in Africa, right? And there was one poem in particular I start the cycle with, where I quote from one of her poems that actually talks about wondering about her mother and dad, wondering how they must feel, right? The second thing was another thing that, as you know, the book was published in England, you know, and to publish the book, Phyllis and a Wheatley representative, I forget which family member, they went over to England. Now, the moment she stepped foot on English soil, she was a free woman, right? But she went back, right? The book was published. The book was a sensation in England, you know. And you know, she was wined and dined. She was a little bit of Oprah at that moment, right? And you know, and then came word that one of the Wheatley's family, one of the daughters of Mrs. Wheatley herself, was ill, and so she just got back on the boat and went back to slavery and went back to Boston. And the scholar asked me, well, why would she do that? Right. So that's the
why would he do that? So that was the trigger.
Yeah.
That was the trigger. Oh, are these going to be in her voice?
No. They're actually,
In the narrator's voice.
They're in the writer's voice.
Well, before we hear a final poem, we have to talk about the creation of Kaveh Khanum with the divine Toy Derricotte. Yes. And it had to be in the 80s, if I remember.
It was 90-something. 96.
Oh, was it 90?
96, 90-something, right?
It feels 20 years ago.
It's 25 years. We're going to do our 25th anniversary starting next week.
What are you doing?
Well, we're doing a number of events. We're starting with a celebratory dinner online, of course, and then we're going to be doing workshops again online. You know, it's going to be like, you know.
Please just tell people what it is how many people have gone through that magic door.
Oh yes. Kaveh Khanum is an African American poetry workshop, ostensibly, that Toy and I began, 25 years ago. It was to give a space. A safe space for African American poets to hang and write and create and just to be. And a lot of people have gone through it.
You see these prize winning poets, and in their resumes are Kaveh Khanum.
Yes, you know.
Aren't you proud?
Yeah, it's also surprising why I haven't done this interview with you for almost 20 years, right? 20 years ago, it was a totally different landscape, right? And, you know, a totally different landscape. And, you know, you'd be lucky, the conventional wisdom then was sort of like you get Gwendolyn Brooks, and then 30 years later, you get Rita Dove, right? The winner of the Pulitzer, and then maybe a couple years later, you know, it wasn't a faucet. The faucet was a little trickle, right? And you know, over the last, few years, over the last 25 years, you know, every poet since Rita Dove, who's won the Pulitzer, has either been a Kaveh Khanum fellow or had a connection to Kaveh Khanum.
Or taught
a Kaveh Khanum, you know, the connection being by either taught. So it's one of those things
we need a book, we need a memoir.
Yeah, we're thinking about that. We're trying to figure out how to.
We have the poems that came out. Yeah. Oh, an anthology. Got to have it.
Grace, we're definitely thinking about that, but trying to figure out how to make that work is going to
be hundreds of pages.
Right, because there's over 400 people have gone through Kaveh Khanum over the 25 years we've been in existence, and yes, you know, prizes isn't the only way you measure, you know, the worth of a poet, you know, but it is really astonishing to see how Kaveh Khanum has had this influence on American poetry. It's also, you know, made people reconsider what African American poetry is and what it contains.
It always takes one or two people to do something. It took you and Toy to create that. You can't wait for the other person to do it. They will not. You have to do it. You did it. You did it.
Yes,
and now we have to have a final poem.
Oh, okay. Yes. Let me see. I'm having so much fun talking, Grace. I forgot what I was thinking about.
You like to make people cry.
So let me see if I can find something.
You don't happen to have the couch on hand, do you?
No, I do happen to have that on hand. The white couch?
That's an awesome poem.
Oh, that's a great poem to close with. I will do this, okay?
It's so you.
Okay. All right. So this is about my wife and I, we're renters. We own houses since then, but it's one of those things where basically we've been renters for a long time, and then we bought a house in upstate New York in Greene County.
Mm.
I say house is more like, you know, the two cottages, you know, kind of broken down cottages side by side, you know, and the driveway between them. But we never had ownership before. The white couch that I found on the curb, a door or two down from the new school in New York, just at the moment my wife and I were looking for furniture for our new house. This is how marriage works. Guy and gal fall in love. Gal moves in. The bachelor pad with the clean white IKEA sofa is out. This is the way marriage works. Guy and gal buy house. Guy and gal fight over what should go in it. Both problems get settled in the street. I sit on the couch. The couch is mine. I grab my cell phone. I call my wife at work. I found a couch. I cannot move or we lose the couch. The couch is perfect. The couch is free. I wait for Sarah. I guard the couch. Don't touch the couch. Don't consider the couch. And now it starts to rain. I will not move from the couch. And now the sun goes down. I will not budge off the couch. Sarah arrives. The couch is perfect. The couch is free. We guard the couch. We are too weak to lift the couch. We are too few to carry the couch. We fear the rain will soak the couch. We are on the couch, but let's be real. It's New York City. We're easy pickings on the couch. A truck might roll by and take the couch. Maybe we're not meant to have this couch. Maybe we're not worthy. Maybe the Greek gods are having fun with us. Look at them, fools! They will not budge off the couch! Then the torrent, the East Village skinhead, the cops. We need a car to carry the couch. We need some ropes to tie down the couch. One of us must leave the couch. One of us must guard the couch. I am the one who leaves the couch. I am the one who looks for Sarah's mom, who gives me her key, who lends us her car. I am the one who walks the streets searching for hope. Anyone who thinks New York never sleeps, so search for rope after 9 p.m. I drift from grocery to magazine shop. What do they think I'm after? My friend, I need something heavier than twine. I examine package after package like a wine snob. Too thin. Too short. Not enough F. Maybe they grunt at what I choose and wait for the headline tomorrow. Oh, yeah, that guy. Night has fallen on the couch. Rain is falling on the couch. My wife is sitting on the couch. What will happen next? How shall we lift the couch? How will we tie down the couch? How far will the couch go before it slips its strings and flies stone-like to the road? And who shall lie beneath the couch? And who shall sue us for this couch? This is where the doorman arrives. He's watched us find and guard the couch. He's watched us find a car to carry the couch. He sees us as we try to lift the couch. This is where the doorman arrives. Like a wood chopper breaks down the door and saves a red-hooded child. Like the wand, the cartoon witch's hand that changes time, space, luck. This is the man who has the rope. This is the man who brings his muscles. And the couch is lifted to the roof of the tiny Chevy. And his rope becomes a tight fist of knots. And he tells us the story of how the couch landed on the curb just before I walked by. And how this happens all the time in the ex-East Bloc country he comes from. Oh, this moving, he says. Ah, he says. This is living. This his life.
Night has fallen on the couch. The voice of Cornelius Eady. This is the poet and the poem. The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipet Fund. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and our engineer is Mike Turpin.
I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
Welcome and good morning to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. This week, Jeff Godsell revisits Paul Schrader's unique biopic about the